Hello, and welcome to There's Hope with Homeopathy. This is a monthly show that airs the third Friday of each month, and it focuses on classical homeopathic treatment and how it can benefit your whole family, and in particular, how it can be a curative therapy in the treatment of autism. My name's Amy Lansky, and I'm broadcasting live this month from Portola Valley, California, which is right near Stanford University in the San Francisco Bay Area. Well, it's a beautiful day today here in California, and I thought I'd start with some current events in the world of homeopathy. You know, one thing that's on many people's mind, largely because of the media pushing it in our faces and you know, for various reasons, is the bird flu and the flu season in general. Well, this may or may not be a real worry for us, at least this year. But the world of homeopathy is also paying attention to this. And this weekend in Paris, there is going to be a one-day conference of homeopathic physicians, MDs who are homeopaths, to discuss the bird flu and the homeopathic response to it. So this is actually a really wonderful thing. I'm a board member of the National Center for Homeopathy, and we are sending a representative to this conference, and there'll be people there, I think mostly from all over Europe. It's being sponsored by Boiron, which is one of the primary homeopathic remedy manufacturers in France. Well, worldwide, but they're based in France. Anyway, hopefully the people there at the conference will come out with some recommendations for the bird flu. As I'll discuss during the later part of this show, it's very important in homeopathy to select a remedy for an epidemic based on the actual symptoms of the patients. And since we have very little information what symptoms these patients are getting with this flu, especially the kind of symptoms homeopaths need to prescribe, I'm not sure they'll be able to come up with too good of a recommendation for specific remedies, although I've heard that there are some symptoms coming out that homeopaths have tried to pick a remedy for this particular bird flu. So I'll be talking all about that later in the show. But the bird flu and the homeopathic response to epidemics really does tie into what I'm going to be talking about today, which is a focus on the history of homeopathy in the United States, and in particular, how it became an extremely popular medicine in the 1800s. And this was largely due to homeopathy's success, and much greater success than any other form of therapy, in treating epidemics. So homeopaths were really successful in treating cholera, typhoid, flu, even smallpox. And as part of this discussion, hopefully I'm not sure how much I'll get to today, but I'll be discussing the treatment of epidemics in general in homeopathy, and I'll talk about flu remedies. Whatever I don't get to today, I will talk about in the December show. Another thing I'm thinking about talking about in the December show is actually a sort of a Christmas present, or a Hanukkah present, or Kwanzaa present, or whatever present, is just give you some more cure stories from my book. Read some cure stories. In January, I want to get the year started off with sort of doing a frequently asked questions kind of show. When I give talks, when I talk to parents of autistic children, they often have very questions that they often ask. So I'm going to try to address lots of those common questions. So it'll be kind of an FAQ show in January. Also for next year, I'm hoping to get more interviews of both homeopaths who treat autistic kids and parents who've had success with homeopathy. Before I get started with the show, I also want to encourage listeners to A, try to listen to past archives of this show, because although each show is more or less self-contained, I'm kind of structuring the show as an introductory course on homeopathy based on my book, which is called Impossible Cure, The Promise of Homeopathy. That's the other thing I want to encourage you all to buy this book, because it will really give you a better idea of what homeopathy is all about and what it's capable of. And it's an extremely comprehensive book. It's not a how-to book, but it's a book that will let you know what homeopathy is all about. It's so comprehensive that it's used as a first-year text at the homeopathic schools, and also really it's pretty much the primary patient education book now in the country. It includes a full chapter about how my son Max was cured of autism thanks to homeopathic treatment, and has lots of other cure stories from people from around the world for a variety of ailments. So you can find out more about how to order Impossible Cure at the Impossible Cure website, which is impossiblecure.com. For the past archives of the show, you can find some of them on the Autism One radio archives, but any of the ones that aren't there are accessible from impossiblecure.com. You can find a link on the main page to access that. So I really do recommend that. In particular, the February show where I describe Max's cure from autism. Okay. Well, also while you're on the Impossible Cure website, you can check out my page about autism treatment, and it has referrals to homeopaths. Okay, so let's get into today's topic, which is the history of homeopathy in the United States, and especially with a focus on epidemics. First of all, let me begin by saying that the best book and the most comprehensive and a huge book, but unbelievably interesting, is about homeopathic history in this country, is written by Julian Winston. And it's called The Faces of Homeopathy. And it's not an easy-to-find book, but I can direct you to two websites where you can buy it. One is called Minimum.com. This is Minimum Price Books. So it's Minimum.com, and this is pretty much an online bookstore where you can pretty much buy any book on homeopathy. So that's a great resource. The other place where you can buy The Faces of Homeopathy is at homeopathyworks.com. And this is the website of Washington Homeopathic Products, which is a pharmacy and also carries some books. Julian Winston was a very good friend of mine. He died this year. He was not only really the premier historian of homeopathy, but he was a pretty famous folk musician, one of our country's best banjo players, and pedal steel guitar players. So an amazing guy, and a good friend of mine. So maybe I'll dedicate this installment of homeopathy, There's Hope with Homeopathy, to Julian, my good friend Julian. Hey Julian, are you up there listening to me? Okay, and another great place, or very simple place, to read about the history of homeopathy is in my book, of course, which is chapter 1. So many people don't realize, including most of today's doctors, that in the 1800s, homeopathy was one of the primary forms of medicine. In fact, medicine in general was a very different kind of affair in this country. There was no licensing laws. As we know it, there were medical societies, but there was no licensing. And at the time, there was three main branches of medicine. One was allopathic or conventional medicine. One was homeopathy. And the third branch was called eclectic medicine, which is essentially a little bit like naturopathy today and herbalists. Now, most of the eclectic doctors were lay practitioners, but most of the allopathic doctors and the homeopathic doctors were all MDs. They were medical doctors who were, at the time, full-service doctors. So that means in the 1800s, most homeopaths were real doctors who did surgery and delivered babies and all the rest. And many of these homeopaths had started off as conventional doctors who switched to practicing homeopathy when they found that it was much more effective than what they were doing at the time. And, in my opinion, still more effective today. By the late 1800s, There were already about 20 homeopathic medical schools in this country, full-blown homeopathic medical schools, and all of these were later converted to just become allopathic schools. The most prominent of the homeopathic medical schools was the Hahnemann Medical School in Philadelphia. And I think I heard they recently changed their name finally to something else. I don't know. But it's a very well-known and respected medical school in Philadelphia today. Hahnemann is the founder of homeopathy, and the school is named for him. And I bet a lot of the allopathic graduates didn't even know what their school was named for. In fact, at the Hahnemann Medical School, homeopathy was a required study until 1940, and it was taught as an elective until 1955. So it was probably the last holdout of teaching homeopathy at a conventional medical school in this country. Other medical schools that began as homeopathic medical schools are the New York Medical College, the Boston University School of Medicine, and the medical school at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Homeopathy was a major form of medicine in this country. It was brought to the United States in the 1830s, which is a time when there was a large wave of German immigration to the United States, and homeopathy originated in Germany. I guess I'll talk about the European history of homeopathy in a different show, but there was a wave of immigration, especially to Pennsylvania, in the 1830s, and many homeopathic physicians came to the United States and began practicing homeopathy. In fact, the very first medical association of any kind in the United States was a homeopathic medical association called the American Institute of Homeopathy, which was founded in 1844 and still exists. I think it still exists to this day. So, in fact, homeopaths were much more open to women physicians, and the very first women's medical college in this country was not one. My son was studying about, I don't know, this subject, and the teachers told him it was a different school, but no, in fact, an earlier medical school was started for women called the New England Female Medical College in 1848, and that was the first medical school for women. And in fact, most of the women doctors in the 1800s were homeopaths. Jane Seymour, who played Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman on, on TV, her sister is actually a homeopath in real life, a British homeopath. And she has often said, and she has testified before Congress about how she uses homeopathy, and she has often said that Dr. Quinn, the pioneer woman doctor, was most likely a homeopath. In fact, homeopathy was the most used form of medicine in the home in the 1800s. The very first American domestic manual, meaning a manual for moms to use with their children, was called The Domestic Physician, and was published in 1835, written by Constantine Herring, M.D., who is considered the founder of American homeopathy. He started the first medical association, founded the Hahnemann Medical School, and was really the focal point of homeopathy in the 1830s in the United States. In fact, I'll tell a little story from my own experience. One year, my family was traveling through Pennsylvania. We were going to Hershey's and stuff like that. And we stopped in Pennsylvania Dutch country in a little town called Lititz. And, we were just wandering around. And I went into a quilt museum. I love quilting. And I'm looking at the quilts. And in the back of the quilt museum is sort of a display of old medical stuff from the 1800s. And there I'm looking at it, and it's all homeopathy. It's like the personal materia medicas of homeopathic physicians describing, use this remedy for that ailment, etc., with little vials of homeopathic remedies sitting there. And I talked to the lady at the quilt factory, and I said, "Do you know what this is? This is homeopathy." And she didn't even know what it was. Well, there it is. So by the end of the 1800s, homeopathy had become really the medicine of the elite in this country, the intelligentsia, the political elite, etc. So we find that people like Susan B. Anthony, one of the founders of women's rights, women's right to vote, etc., in this country, used homeopathy. Her homeopath was one of the women homeopaths, Julia Smith, M.D., who practiced in Chicago. Susan B. Anthony's colleague, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, was considered a talented lay homeopath, and her brother-in-law was a prominent homeopathic physician. Presidents used homeopathy, too. President McKinley was a supporter of homeopathy. He was at the unveiling of the Hahnemann Monument in Washington, D.C., which still stands there today, and I went and visited it this summer. It was dedicated in 1900. President McKinley chose a spot for it so that he could see it from the White House. It's still located today at 16th Street and Massachusetts Avenue, which is on the currently on the row where all the embassies are, on the street where all the embassies are. And it's being restored right now. We had a centennial celebration for it, the World of Homeopathy, in 2000, and it's currently being restored. Another president that was a big supporter of homeopathy is Harding, who actually held a conference of homeopaths at the White House in 1922. His own father was a homeopathic physician. So now, even as late as World War I, homeopathy was still very prominent. There were homeopathic medical corps in World War I. And at the end of World War I, there was the 1918 flu epidemic, which so many of us talk about now because it was so deadly. Like, over 500,000 people died in the United States from this epidemic. And a lot of people say part of the reason why it occurred was because at the end of the war, all the soldiers and all this and that, people, the situation was very bad with hygiene, etc., death, you know, the war, which aided the spread of the flu. And there are many accounts of ships of men coming back from the war where in the boats where homeopathy was used, there were essentially no deaths or very few deaths, and in the ships where conventional medicine was used was huge amounts of deaths. In general, the death rate from that flu, 1918 flu epidemic, was 30% for conventional doctors, and for homeopaths, the death rate was only 1%, in some cases 0% in many practices. I thought I would read to you just a little excerpt here that I find very cute. This is from Julian Winston's book. It's a quote from somebody named W.F. Edmondson in Pittsburgh, M.D. It said, I'll just read this quote. It says, "One physician in a Pittsburgh hospital asked a nurse if she knew anything better than what he was doing because he was losing so many cases. 'Yes, doctor, stop the aspirin and go down to a homeopathic pharmacy and get homeopathic remedies.' The doctor replied, 'But that is homeopathy.' She said, 'I know it, but the homeopathic doctors for whom I have nursed have not lost a single case.'" And that was pretty much the story. Actually, the remedy that was the right homeopathic remedy in that epidemic was gelsimium, which is made from a flower, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. The spread of popularity of homeopathy began in the United States. The thing that really triggered it was the 1832 cholera epidemic, which was worldwide, and homeopaths had great success both in Europe and in the United States. And that's really what triggered many homeopathic conventional doctors to start using homeopathy. Now, Hahnemann was also having amazing successes in Europe, too, in Germany. He published his very first paper about homeopathy, and had to do with the use of homeopathy in epidemics. There was a paper published in 1801 about a scarlet fever epidemic where he had great success, and the remedy in that particular case was belladonna. I'm going to read you another quote now from my own book. This is about Hahnemann's success in a typhoid fever epidemic in 1813. The reason I'm reading this is because it will say some. I'm going to start talking about what happened to homeopathy in this country. Okay, this quote from my book. The efficacy, actually, and this is a quote from another book by Rima Handley, about which is a biography of Hahnemann. The efficacy of homeopathy became particularly apparent in 1813 after the terrible Battle of Leipzig between the Prussian forces and Napoleon's army, retreating from the fiasco of Moscow. After 3 days of fighting just outside the city, there were 80,000 dead and 80,000 wounded. The streets were choked with refugees. It rained incessantly, food supplies were short, and the drinking water was polluted. Of the 180 victims whom Hahnemann was able to treat, only two died. Hahnemann's success, however, only increased the anger of the Orthodox, meaning the conventional doctors. His flourishing practice in Leipzig also aroused opposition. Well, this was the story. Hahnemann's experience also became the experience of homeopaths in the United States. Their success was considered very threatening to conventional doctors. One of the first things that happened was in 1847, the American Medical Association was formed. And the very first sentence of their charter was a veiled, essentially, directive that forbade any of its members to associate socially or collaboratively with homeopaths. After the 1850s, this just escalated. It got worse and worse. So now I'm going to read another quote from, this is actually from Julian Winston's book. So by the mid-1850s, all the state medical societies except the Massachusetts Medical Society purged their homeopathic members. In 1856, the American Medical Association also decided that homeopathic works would no longer be discussed or reviewed in the allopathic periodicals. After this time, there was no formal communication whatsoever between the two branches of the profession. The allopaths were forbidden to consult with homeopathic physicians or to patronize their pharmacies. In 1878, a physician was expelled from a local medical society in Connecticut for consulting with a homeopath, his wife. One of the leaders in Washington was Tullio Verdi, who was the first homeopath appointed to the Bureau of Health in Washington, D.C., and he was the physician to Secretary of State William Seward. When Lincoln was assassinated, there was also an attempt on the life of Seward. The White House doctor attended Seward and told Verdi when he arrived what he had done. For consulting with a homeopath, this White House doctor was severely censured by the Washington Medical Society. So you get an idea of what was going on here. Basically, the homeopathic physicians became more and more socially ostracized. And this led to a variety of things, including the downfall of homeopathy in this country. So just to give you an idea, in 1902, by some reckonings anyway, there were 15,000 homeopathic practitioners in this country. About 2,000 who were members of something called members of the American Institute of Homeopathy. By 1963, there were under 1,500 practitioners, only 217 members of the American Institute of Homeopathy. And by 1980, there were only 128 practitioners in the whole United States, with about 100 in the American Institute of Homeopathy. So what happened? What happened? Well, actually, this is not just the story of homeopathy, but the story of many different forms of alternative medicine in this country. Well, the first thing that happened, this is in particular to homeopathy, was that by 1900, most homeopaths in the country were not really practicing classical or real homeopathy anymore. After all this censure, all this stuff, that it became very hard for homeopaths, and all these social pressures, and there started being essentially a watering down of the teaching of homeopathy in their own medical schools. So homeopaths started using other techniques, eclectic techniques, allopathic techniques, and as many call them, many today call them, they were half homeopaths. They weren't true homeopaths. As a result, their results really began to suffer. What they were doing became increasingly ineffective. And as that happened, they started turning more and more to allopathic medicine, which was starting to actually have some techniques that had some effects. The use of aspirin, which actually was part of the contributor to death in the 1918 flu epidemic. Nevertheless, there was now this drug aspirin, there were x-rays, and starting to be other new techniques which the allopaths used, which made their practice very simple. The practice of homeopathy is very difficult because it's individualized to the patient. So basically, homeopaths themselves and their medical schools became sort of only half homeopathy. The other thing that was happening simultaneously was the rising power of allopathic medicine, and in particular, the drug manufacturing companies. In 1910, there was a report called the Flexner Report. This was commissioned by Andrew Carnegie and the American Medical Association. And the goal, the stated goal of the report, was to rate or assess America's medical schools. But the covert intent of the report was really to essentially get rid of all forms of alternative medicine. So the results of this report, it basically panned all the non-allopathic medical schools. And as a result, if these schools got a low rating, they were then barred, their graduates were barred from even taking the state medical board exams. So essentially, the people who were graduating from these schools could no longer become practicing physicians. Even if they were able to pass the exams, but they weren't allowed to take the exams. And so, of course, these schools folded or got converted to allopathy, and the numbers of homeopaths just simply went increasingly down as the homeopaths got older and died. So this was the death knell to homeopathy in the United States, not just homeopathy, but chiropractic, eclectic medicine such as naturopathy, etc. So what happened? Well, in the 1970s, 1980s, there started being a comeback, a renewal of homeopathy as well as these other forms of medicine. In homeopathy, essentially what happened was that a group of doctors in the Bay Area, sort of hippie doctors, started looking for a new way to treat especially chronic disease. I'm not even sure how it happened, but they discovered homeopathy. They didn't know anything about it, but they rediscovered it, and they heard about its ability to actually treat and cure chronic disease. So they actually found remaining homeopaths in this country. By that time, there was probably just about 100, and they were very old. And they studied with them, and these new homeopaths, and many of them, or most of them at that time, were actually doctors. Also went to Europe and studied with a homeopath there. Homeopathy had remained a constant thing. I mean, I guess the numbers of homeopaths had gone down, but it remained very popular and viable, largely because elites such as the royal family in England, other wealthy people used homeopathy, and it just stayed alive. Anyway. So slowly, since the 1980s, and that was about the time that the National Center for Homeopathy was started, homeopathy has slowly, gradually made a comeback. But it's still struggling, really. There are less than 1,000 homeopaths in the country today, and less than 500 of these are certified homeopaths. And organizations like the National Center for Homeopathy are still kind of struggling to stay afloat, really need your membership, by the way. So we still have a long way to go, but we're growing. And as you know, people are starting to be aware of homeopathy, mostly through mixed remedies in health food stores. But really the most effective way to get homeopathic treatment is from a homeopath, especially. One can never self-treat for something like autism because the treatment is completely individualized to the child. And if you give 10 autistic kids, they might all need different remedies. So I do have a little time. It's already almost 11:30, but I'm going to start a little bit about the treatment of epidemics. I guess I'm going to talk about flu, in particular flu remedies, next month. But let's talk a little bit about epidemics, how homeopaths treat epidemics. Well, in general, homeopaths prefer not to treat for an epidemic until the picture of the epidemic is known. So especially in a flu epidemic, every flu is very different, and different remedies will be most useful for each of the epidemics. Now, there's 5-10 remedies that are most often used, and it's good to know those. Homeopaths will prefer to treat people once they know what the characteristics of this of a particular epidemic is known. So how is it's done? Once people start getting sick, homeopaths will have a few cases, and they'll essentially what we call take the case of the epidemic, which is they'll see a cross section of patients, gather up their symptoms, and find a small set of remedies that covers these symptoms that people in general are experiencing. And this set of remedies is called the genus epidemicus. Usually there's about 2 to 5 remedies that cover the symptoms people are getting. And these remedies will be useful in not only treating people who get that disease, let's say the flu, but also as a prophylactic. So for those who haven't gotten it yet, they can take a remedy from the genus epidemicus and will use it will work as a prophylactic. And this has proved successful in many epidemics. Now, there's a couple interesting and key things here. First of all, in homeopathy, the really useful symptoms for finding these remedies are not the ones we hear about in the news, let's say for the flu. They're not readings, they're not measurements of the body or just very general names of symptoms. They have to be very much more specific. For example, the mental and emotional state of the patients. Are the patients anxious, fearful, or are they very lethargic and listless? You know, that's very important. Are they thirsty or are they thirstless? What do they look like? What are specific pains and sensations they have in their body? In other words, it's not information like from tests or diagnoses like of specific kinds that's going to be really important. I mean, it is important to know that this is a respiratory thing or whatever, but these much more personal symptoms are the symptoms that will lead to the correct remedy. And unfortunately, like for example, for this bird flu epidemic, that kind of information isn't coming out or isn't available to homeopaths yet for the most part. Now, the beauty of the homeopathic method, though, is that it doesn't even matter what the disease is or what caused it or what virus. You know, it could be Ebola, it could be anything, but if you got those symptoms, if you have that patient in front of you and you can see his symptoms, the symptoms he reports to you, not from a test, then you can find a remedy for it. You don't need to find a vaccine. You don't need to identify what bacteria or virus or whatever caused it. All you need to know is the symptoms and treat those symptoms using the remedies that homeopaths have already. So really, what's amazingly fantastic about the homeopathic treatment of epidemics is that it can be used to treat any disease, even diseases we don't know what the hell they are. So this is a great thing. Let me I'm making some good progress here. So I am going to talk a bit about the treatment of the flu. Let's start with prevention of the flu. What do we do if we don't know what the flu symptoms are going to be yet? Well, there's approaches people use. Now, the best approach, and the one I myself use, is simply to stay in good health, go to your homeopath, be healthy, because those who are healthy are less susceptible to any disease, including the flu. But there's things people have done, and they have been, there's studies been done that these methods are useful. And one of them is there's a couple remedies that people have taken as a general preventative. One is called influenzinum, which is a remedy, so it's very dilute. It's not like a vaccine, but it's made from a previous flu virus. It's certainly much better and safer than a vaccine, it's made, let's say, from the previous year's flu virus. And this, the, in general, influenzinum is not useful as a cure for the flu. You want to know what the symptoms are. But and the genus Epidemicus remedies are going to be better preventatives, but it's something, and people have found success with that. And you can get those remedies at the homeopathic pharmacies. Another remedy that people have found useful is called acylococcinum. It's made by Boiron, and it's made from, interestingly, from duck liver. There's been at least three studies shown that it does decrease the impact of the flu if it's taken right at the onset. If you feel the onset, you take this remedy, and it wipes that out relatively quickly. And it's interesting, it's made from duck liver, since most flus are sort of bred and transmitted in birds. So now I'm just going to go over three or four of the most popular flu remedies. I'm going to start with gelsimium, because that's the remedy that was the remedy for the 1918 flu epidemic. In gelsimium, the onset is rather slow, and the person seems like this. These are the characteristics. First of all, they're very tired. They're like, very apathetic, drowsy, like benumbed, you know. I'm going to just go over certain characteristics. Their fever is they have heat alternating with chills, with shivers and chills running up and down the spine, but they are not sweaty. So they're very listless. They're also aching. There's aching all over the back. It's sort of ache, heavy and weak, but not severe pain, just sort of heavy, weak, you know, like that. They have a dull headache, and their eyes and their head are heavy, and they might have double vision, and they're thirstless, so not thirsty. And they feel better from, their headache feels better from peeing, from urinating, and they also feel better from being out in the open air and sweating if they can. There's also kind of a trembling in the limbs. The eyelids might be heavy. The headache might be run from the neck to the head and the forehead. So that's gelsimium, a particular kind of flu. A different flu, a common type of flu, is Eupatorium flu. It's a very different picture. In the Eupatorium patient, the most obvious or strong symptom is very severe pain in the limbs and the back. It's so painful, it feels like your bones are broken. So that's the Eupatorium flu. There's shivering, chills down the back, a bursting headache, the eyeballs feel sore. And this, in Eupatorium, they're very thirsty for cold drinks, and they feel worse from any kind of movement at all. Everything feels sore in Eupatorium. The skin feels sore, the muscles, there's shivering and chills. And though they may thirst for the cold water, they may vomit food. And the headache, they might have nausea with the headache and have a very sore chest, so this soreness. And I'll do, one other flu remedy, and then I'll close down here. We can talk a little bit more next time, but the third common flu remedy is called bryonia. And in bryonia, once again, this is a slow onset kind of flu. And the fever is very hot and dry, and they ache all over. But the pain is from any kind of movement, even like turning, you know, shaking the head, hurts behind the eyes, you know. But their headache feels better from like putting some pressure, especially on the forehead, you know, putting pressure on the forehead. But very much worse, all the pain's worse from movement of the body. The eyeballs are sore. In bryonia, they're also really thirsty, very thirsty. They say bry is dry, very dry. And the bryonia patient's very grumpy. They just want to be left alone. Leave me alone. So that's three remedies. An important book on the flu in this country, and just What to Do for the Flu, is written by Sandra Perko, P-E-R-K-O. So if you want to prepare for the flu, this is a great book to buy, Sandra Perko's flu book. So, well, and maybe next show, too, I'll talk a little bit more about the flu and see what results come out about ideas for this particular flu epidemic if the bird flu comes. I think it's going to be different remedies. They're going to be very heavily respiratory remedies. But the best place to go for an update on this kind of information and getting articles and stuff, too, is the National Center for Homeopathy. And their website is homeopathic.org, so H-O-M-E-O-P-A-T-H-I-C.org. There's a facility in the website called the Flu Tracker, and in there you can find pointers to all kinds of articles. And as we find out more about what the genus epidemic is for this year's flu, that we'll be putting information there. Well, that's about all I have time for this week. I just want to close and encourage you again to go to visit the ImpossibleCure.com website. And another great resource is Homeopathy for Special Needs Children, which is a website in Yahoo group. So you can find out about that at homeopathysnc.org. Besides my book, another useful book is one that came out this year, published by Judith Reichenberg Ullman, Robert Ullman, and Ian Lipker, on homeopathy for autistic children. You can find those, my book and her book, on their book on at Amazon. And that's about it for now. And I want you all to remember, there really is hope with homeopathy. We don't have anything to fear with this flu. Just read up about the flu remedies and just be prepared. Get your remedies and don't worry. Don't worry. There's hope with homeopathy.